The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Chapter 12. Vayomer Hashem el Avram. And Hashem said to Avram, Lech lecha me'artzecha mimoladetcha mibeit avicha el ha'aretz asher ereka. Yesterday we were talking about what was chosen about Abraham. What was special about Abraham? We pointed out how there are no credentials for our great-great-grandfather. There's no resume. There is this ambiguous stranger, a character who all I know of is who his father is and who his wife is and that they're traveling, but I know nothing else about him, and that seems very, very strange. Very strange. And we did point out that the oral tradition is very rich with various wonderful stories about Abraham, how he was a monotheist, he came to an understanding of an abstract God over a idolatrous community. You have to be the Einstein of your time when everybody's telling you that rocks and trees and all these statues have meaning, and you all of a sudden say no, right? So Avram is a genius. Avram is beyond his time. Avram is willing to act upon what he believes in, and he goes out and radically destroys the idol collection of King Nimrod at the risk of his own life, at the risk of his own livelihood. He dissuades people from purchasing idols, even though his father owned an idol warehouse. We also pointed out that not only philosophically, not only ideologically, but also in terms of his attribute, ethically, he's a wonderful person, he's a kind person, he had a tent that only had doors, no walls, so he could see, had maximal visibility to bring in any stranger. And those are all fantastic and important stories that give us a sense of this personality. But what's interesting and strange and disturbing is that none of this is written prior to this encounter with God. We would have hoped to hear some kind of good words about the man, and then, understandably so, he'd have a revelation, right? But there's absolutely nothing about him, and he has a revelation, all right? We pointed out that in contrast to Noah, who was the prime character before Abraham, well, the Bible has no problem saying, Noah ish tzaddik, tamim, he was righteous, he was pure, he walked with God, and God said to Noah, build an ark. I now understand. Noah was unusual. And I understand why God would speak to Noah. But I don't understand why God is speaking to Abraham. So we pointed out a couple ideas yesterday. Number one, it's important to understand the distinction between Avram's chosenness and Noah's chosenness. Okay? Noah's chosenness means rejection of the world. The world had reached such a low point that the world was destined to destruction. And only Noah was chosen from amongst mankind to reestablish mankind. So Noah's chosenness is a statement of rejection to a world. All right? But Avram's chosenness is not a rejection of the world, but rather Avram's chosenness is God's affirmation, God's commitment to the world, because God says to Abram, and through you, the world will be blessed. Okay? And that's very important to understand the universal position that the Jew has. That the Jewish people are to be a conduit of blessing to all of mankind. And we'll talk about that more. We're going to have a whole class on the meaning of the chosen people. Alright, so don't fret. Yet. Alright. We also pointed out that if in fact Abraham has no character references prior to this encounter, so that must mean that whatever I need to know about Abraham is written here. and that's chosen is not based on some past activity, but rather something that happened right now. Right? And we spoke about how really God speaks to us every single day. Let me read to you something. Return to God is an answer to Him. He's talking about the word tshuva. Tshuva, which literally means repentance, also literally means to return, also literally means to answer. A tshuva is an answer. A person has a she'ela, that's a question. A tshuva is an answer. What does it mean that a person is doing tshuva? It doesn't only mean that they're repenting, it means they're answering God's call. Okay? That's what tshuva also means. It means to answer the call. Return to God is an answer to Him, for God is not silent. Okay? God is not silent. According to the understanding of the rabbis, daily, at all times, a voice, this is a verse from Isaiah 40, verse 3, a voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Right? That's always. The rabbis, the sages teach us that every single day, all times, the voice of God is calling out to us. The voice of the Lord cries to the city. This is from Micha. Morning by morning He wakens my ear to hear as those who are taught. And that's from Isaiah 50, verse 4. The stirring in man to turn to God is actually a reminder by God to man. In other words, when a person feels a certain inner stirring, a certain inner yearning to come to a higher place in their life, to seek a relationship with Hashem, well, so that stirring itself is God's voice. Right? Where did it come from? I mean, we've all had this experience where something just, you know, we were talking about it yesterday, something just hits me, something's just clear, something's aroused inside me, and I feel I've got to make a change, I feel I've got to seek something out, I feel something's wrong. Well, what is that? Where did it come from? That is what we were talking about yesterday, the inner voice, which is the voice of God that begins to stir within me. When I have a certain arousal within, that itself is actually a reminder by God to man. I hear the voice of God in my inner stirrings, in my inner yearnings. Alright? The voice of God is not always inaudible. In every generation didst thou make plain parts of the mystery of thy name. It's a verse. Every day a heavenly voice resounds from Mount Horeb, which is Mount Sinai where the Torah was given, proclaiming woe unto the people for their disregard of the Torah. Every day a voice goes forth saying, how long will scoffers delight in the scoffing, and fools hate knowledge? Return, O faithless sons, I will heal your faithlessness. But there is no one who inclines his ear. The Torah calls on man, no one pays attention. The Baal Shem Tov raised the question, what is the purpose of the voice? If no one ever hears it, of what avail is it? If there is always one who hears it, would he presume to admit it? And would anybody believe him? This is how the Baal Shem Tov explained it. The voice that goes forth from above does not reach the physical ear of man. There is no speech, there is no words, the voice is not heard. It is uttered not in sounds, but in thoughts, in signs that man must learn to perceive. A man who does not understand what he is being shown by gesture is not worthy to converse in signs before the king. It's a teaching. All the longings to return to God that come to man, as well as all the inner awakenings of either joy or fear, are due to that voice. Alright? So this is giving a different sensitivity of what the voice of God sounds like. The voice of God comes to us like thoughts, right? Or sometimes in thoughts to our minds, in certain signs, in certain gestures. And we need to be sensitive to that. Alright, he also explains a little later, brings down another piece. Hear, O Israel. What does it mean, hear, O Israel? When we say the Shema, Shema Yisrael, Shem Elokei Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, God is one. Every day a voice goes out from Mount Horeb, which the righteous men perceive. This is meant by "Hear, O Israel." That's why, what is it? If we were going to say, "Israel, God is one." Okay, fine, you make a philosophical statement. But when we say, "Hear, O Israel, God is one," what am I supposed to hear? Right? What am I telling people to do? Hear it, because the truth of God's oneness is being communicated to you at every moment. At every single moment. And what you need to do is hear it. But where? Is it a physical sound? It's an inner voice. It's an inner sound. And every day a voice comes, goes out from Horeb, which the righteous perceive. This is meant by "Hear, O Israel." Israel, thou hear the voice that proclaims all the time, at every moment, the Lord is one, the Lord is one. The act of God, the acts of God are eternal and continue forever. Every day he who is worthy receives the Torah standing at Sinai. He hears the Torah from the mouth of the Lord as Israel did when they stood at Sinai. Every Israelite is able to attain that level, the level of standing at Sinai. It's an amazing idea. Sinai is something that continues to happen every single day, according to our tradition. It wasn't simply a one-time experience. But rather that voice, that connection with the divine voice that speaks to us through us, that's happening all the time. And therefore, I bring this in. Well, let me read you a little more, because it's very, very, didn't have a chance to photocopy them, sorry, but I think it's very important. This is a verse from the Song of Songs. "I sleep, but my heart waketh. It is the voice of my beloved that knocketh. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove." What does it mean? I'm sleeping, but my heart is awake. Okay? "And the voice of the beloved is knocking." Knocking where? So he says like this. "The voice of my beloved, the Holy One, blessed be He, is calling. Open to me an opening, no bigger than the eye of a needle, and are open to thee the supernal gates. Open to me, my sister, because thou art the door through which there is entrance to me." It's an amazing thing. This is from the Talmud. "If thou openest not, I am closed." What's that supposed to mean? How is God knocking on the door of my heart? From within my heart. Okay? From within my heart. Remember, that's a whole new, you know, I'm pushing us towards quite a paradigm shift to get out of the conception of God is over there, right? And I'm over here. And that God is just another big you over there. But rather, God is at the source of all being. And that therefore communicates to me through me. And therefore, what do I hear? This voice from Song of Song, "Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove." God is speaking. The voice of my beloved is calling, "Open to me your heart. Just the eye of a needle. And that'll be enough. And the light will just pour right through. But I have to open my heart. To the inside of my insides, to the inner higher self, which is what we call Hashem. Open to me, my sister, because thou art the door through which there is entrance to me." How do you get to God? Where is the door to God? You are the door to God. Your heart is the door to God. And that's what the Talmud teaches. "If thou openest not, I am closed." And therefore, this is what I was talking about yesterday. How what was incredible about Abraham is his openness, okay, to hear this. And then everybody hears this, because our tradition teaches that everyone hears this and is always hearing this. Actually, I'm sorry. Not everybody hears this. This is being spoken to everyone, right? But not everybody hears this. Because in order to hear this, one must be very, very open. One must be very, very flexible. One cannot be locked and fixated in their plans on the way they think life has to be. Right? That's just the way it is. You know, the Talmud says that if a person gets angry, it's as if they have committed idolatry. And you say, what? I mean, a person loses their temper. What does that got to do with idolatry? I'll tell you one idea. Why does a person lose their temper? Because things are not going the way they planned. That's why they get upset. Right? They get upset because this is the way I envisioned this. This is what I expected. This is what I expected for me. And this is what I expected for, you know, my friends and for my world. And if it's not happening, I get angry. Right? I get angry. And that, what does that basically mean? It means that I don't realize that there's one reality, one God, that ultimately runs the show. Right? And if things don't go the way I planned, tough noogies. Right? It's not the way I planned, so what's, oh, so there's another plan. So I have to get used to another plan. Right? But I don't get angry. That doesn't mean I just give up and say, well, I don't try to work this out. But I shouldn't get angry. Because if I get angry, it means that I've become so convinced that the way I see things, and the way I plan things, the way I expect things to happen, must happen. Otherwise I get angry. And that's not an open human being. That's not a free human being. That's not a person that rolls with the punches of life. Alright? And therefore, so too over here, our sages teach us, the Torah teaches, that God is speaking to us all the time. Does He speak to us in the kind of way that I speak to you? No, no. But God speaks to us in another kind of language. And that language might be just intuitions that all of a sudden hit me. That language might be thoughts. That language might be little signs. I don't know what the language is always. But I need to be open to listening. And therefore, the door to God is my heart. Right? The door to God is my heart. And God is knocking on my door to open up and listen. And this is what Abraham was doing. Let's read a little more. Again and again his call goes out to the soul. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove. But the call is usually lost in the confusion of the heart, in the ambiguity of the world. And that's why I can't hear, because I'm so confused and everything's so ambiguous that I don't have the calm. Right? In order to hear the voice of God, you have to be really calm. Right? If you're in a frenzy, you're just not going to hear. I mean, when we're in a frenzy, we don't hear anybody. Certainly not the source of our soul, we're not going to hear. And therefore, this voice gets lost in confusion of the heart, ambiguity of the world. Yet God tries in many ways to reach the soul. Many ways to reach the soul. This is the power of Abraham. All the Torah wants us to know is that he heard it. Right? Not who he was before that. Because that's not the essence of the moment. That's not the essence of who he is to us. And what he demonstrates to us, and what he is a model for. He's a model for a person who listens, who is open, who is not afraid to make the move, to make the choice, to take the risk, to step into darkness, to step into unknown. And only such a person can take a spiritual journey. Only such a person can take the journey of life. And this is what's great about Abraham. God says, go. He heard it. That itself is tremendous. And he acted upon it. And he said, yes. Okay? And that we talked about yesterday is the image of Jewish living. Response, ability. The ability to respond is predicated upon the possibility to hear and the courage to say yes. Or no, depends. Responsibility sometimes to say no. Right? You got to know that too. But in this case, Avram saw that it was correct to say yes. We talked about why is it that God gives him all these promises. Okay? And does this not disturb us to think that really maybe our great-great Zadie, Judaism starts off with an opportunist, an entrepreneur, right? Who is only fueled by the vision of power, wealth, and fame. Because that's what God promised him. Power, wealth, and fame. And yet we are told that Avram went as God told him. That's to tell us that he went because God said, and not because of the rewards that he was promised. We still have to ask ourselves, why then does God promise him these rewards? One answer could be that's part of the test. Can he do it for the sake of doing it rather than these rewards? That's number one. Number two, we still have to ask though that, okay, fine. So he transcended the desire to have, and he did it motivated in order to be in a relationship with God. Fine. But what is the role of power, wealth, and fame? Okay? What is the role of power, wealth, and fame? Why is it that he was not blessed with consciousness, the world to come, and Torah? Do you follow? Because I could have said that too. I promise you get the Torah. I promise you your children will stand at Sinai. You know, God never said that to Abraham. The entire book of Genesis mentions nothing of a promise that the Jewish people will get a Torah. But rather, the whole promise revolves around getting the land of Israel and establishing a country which will have the presence of God. It's important to recognize the centrality of the land of Israel and building a Jewish state, what it really means to the Jewish people. But it's important to understand that something in this promise seems to be contradictory. God promises Abraham power, wealth, and fame, and yet on the other hand says, through you the world will be blessed. Right? Through you the world will be blessed. What's the problem with that? Doesn't that sound like a contradiction? Right? The world will be blessed by you having power, wealth, and fame? Right? Is that going to bring wealth and fame? Is that going to bring blessing to the world? What do you think? Has power, wealth, and fame brought blessing to the world? Well, just think about this. How about the infamous words of, imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be one. I wrote that. And this guy stole it from me. All right, my last life. Right? That's amazing, right? Imagine. John Lennon saying, listen, it's nationalism, it's money, it's possession that interferes with the dream of world peace. And I'm telling you, Judaism is accepted. Right? Because that's the world we're in. We're in a world of money, we're in a world of power, we're in a world of nationalism, and it's with that that we need to achieve peace. Right? And we can't pretend we don't have that. We can't pretend that's not part of our world. It is part of our world. The way we achieve a universal blessing is not by somehow deluding ourselves to think that mankind will achieve some kind of status of homogenized humanity, where we're all going to be the same, where people are not going to have self-interest. But true peace is a oneness that's so great, right, that even nationalism and money and power and fame will not interfere with that oneness. And this is exactly what Avram has to demonstrate to the world, that he can be in a position. He can be a politician, he can be an economist, he can be a famous personality, a celebrity, and yet still love the world, and still care about human beings, and never, ever, ever undermine human dignity by manipulating human beings. Now that is a demonstration of true peace, right? And therefore, this is God's blessing. Anybody reading this would think this is a curse. Certainly, if God would have offered this to John Lennon, he'd say this is a curse. Right? But the Jewish people say, no, it's a blessing to be able to be real. It's a blessing to be able to live in the world with the dynamics of the world, and yet, we could be different. You can have your religion, I can have my religion. You can have your nation, I can have my nation. You can have your money, I can have my money, and yet we can live in brotherhood. And if we can't, we're fooling ourselves, right? By trying to pull these things away. And so it's important to understand that this is the blessing that God blesses him. God blesses him with the opportunity to demonstrate the highest form of brotherhood, universal brotherhood and sisterhood. Because as a nation, as a religion, as a man of power and wealth and fame, I can and I must and I will respect you. And we will live in peace. Okay. This, by the way, is the identity crisis that's going on right now. in the Jewish people. The role of nationalism is the great big nut that has to be cracked. And the identity crisis that's going on right now, right? And I'm telling you, it's an identity crisis. When a non-Jew kills a Jew, it's murder. When a Jew kills a Jew, it's suicide, right? And why do teenagers commit suicide? Because they've reached a devastating, tragic moment of identity crisis. And that's really exactly what's going on historically. The Jewish people have reached teenage. I mean, now I'm hoping after this crisis, we're going to become adults finally and ask ourselves, so who are we? What are we doing here? Right? Why is this land important? Is this land important? What are we doing here in the first place? Why don't we go move to Miami? Wonderful palm trees there too. Right? And plenty of people speaking Hebrew. Right? On Miami Beach. Right? Could go there too. And so this is important to understand that God says to Avraham to go. Avraham says, God, your wish is my command. I want to do it as a command. Right? I don't want to do it for achieving those blessings. I want to do it because you said do it. Okay. There's a couple of other things going on here. It's amazing what you can get from just a few verses. Imagine if you explore the Torah with this kind of depth. As I said before, never read the Torah. It's not good reading material, but it's excellent learning material. It's excellent reflective material. You know, one must employ their soul and to ask the questions. If you ask the questions and you research, you'll find tremendous answers in the Torah and in yourself. Okay, there's something else that someone brought up yesterday. Why is this directive of God in the wrong order? In other words, it says, leave your country, your birthplace, and your father's home to a land that I will show you. It seems to be in the wrong order. All right? It's not in the wrong order. It's in the right order. Because what Avram is being asked to do is not only a geographical journey, but what he's being asked to do is to take a spiritual journey. Okay? A spiritual journey. It's also geographical. But let's face it, when people travel the world, they're not traveling the world so that they can get bonus points for, you know, travel air. Right? Air points, what do they call that? Traveling points? They do it because they are hoping that in these travels they will somehow see themselves and find themselves. Okay? So every physical journey can be and should be a spiritual journey. But it's important to know that you don't have to make a physical journey to take a spiritual journey. One could explore the universe through themselves. One could spend their whole life exploring the terrain of their own selves, right, without moving. And that could keep them very interested, even though they might not be able to take as many pictures. Okay. This is a spiritual journey. What's the spiritual journey? One second. This seems to be in contradiction in what God is telling Avram to do. On one hand, he's being told, Lech Lecha, which suggests go to yourself, go for yourself, find the Lecha, find the self, and the other hand tells him to leave himself. Because what is the foundation of our sense of self? The foundation of our sense of self is our country, our birthplace, our family. That's the foundation of ourselves. You know, I'm from Canada, Toronto, my parents are this. I mean, that's the foundation of ourselves. So how do you tell a person to go seek themselves while simultaneously telling them to let go of themselves? All right? In addition, how do you tell a person to leave their country and their city and leave their family and then tell them that they're going to become wealthy, powerful, famous? How does one do that? I mean, generally, if you want to build some kind of empire, you don't become some wanderer. You don't show up at some other country as a stranger and hope that somehow you're going to be in a very strong position, right? You've just given up your citizen rights. You've given up your family ties, right? If a person wants to build themselves into a national figure. They don't go, I don't go move to China and hope that somehow over a few years I'm going to be the leader of China. Right? It just doesn't work that way. And so it also seems pretty impractical to say to Avram to leave all these things and then to tell Avram that he's going to achieve all these things which are generally achieved by maintaining those things, not letting go of those things. So it's important to understand what God is really asking Avram to do. Avram is being asked to let go of that which defines most people's identity. Most people's identity, the foundation of their identity, is defined by their country, their birthplace, their family. It's in that order because that is the more difficult order. Okay? It's hard to leave and say, I'm no longer Canadian. But it's not so hard. But it is. It's still a challenge. It's harder to say, I'm no longer a Torontonian. Grew up there my whole life. But okay. But it's even harder to say, I'm no longer part of that family. It's very hard. It's in the order of psychological difficulty that God instructed them to do this. Because this physical journey is a spiritual journey. And the spiritual journey is to let go of that which defines most people's identity and accept a completely new identity. A completely new sense of self. Right? And what is that new sense of self? One which is defined by a relationship with God. That's what he's being asked to do. That his identity, and I want to make clear, what happens to Avraham and what is asked of Avraham is not asked of you. Right? You can't learn from Avraham completely and say, well, if he did it, then that's what I'm supposed to do. Right? That's what he had to do in order to create the Jewish people. Because the Jewish people, their identity according to Judaism is defined by their relationship to God. We are called B'nai B'rith, children of a covenant, right? And it's no accident, because that is the foundation of Jewish identity. Jewish identity is founded upon a relationship with God. And God is saying, and I will make you a great nation. And I will bless you. And I will make you famous. Because your identity and your success will be a function of your relationship to me. Alright? And that's really the remarkable mystery of Jewish identity. That we still exist. Against all odds. Right? All odds. There's a historian by the name of Toynbee. He points out that all nations have a standard format of how they achieve nationhood. And he demonstrates how every nation in the world follows this standard format, except the Jews. The Jews did it totally backwards. Everything that constitutes nationhood for other nations just simply did not work with the Jewish people. Right? The Jewish people were out of their land much more than they were in their land, on and on and on and on and on. How is it that the Jewish people survive? How is it that the Jewish people take a Roman and exile him from Rome? How long will he stay a Roman? Right? How long will he stay a Roman? The Jewish people throughout history have experienced being thrown out of their land. We've been out of our land more than we've been in our land. Okay? The Jewish people have experienced their possessions constantly being confiscated from them. The Jewish people experience constantly losing family members. Right? Their land, their money, their parents, constantly taken away, and yet the Jewish people still exist. You know, there's a plant called the Wandering Jew. You know this plant? You think Jews gave that plant that name? Right? You think that's a big honor? Hey, let's call a plant after us. Maybe they'll remember us. What kind of name is that for a plant? The Wandering Jew is a plant that if you cut it, you can put it anywhere, it'll grow. That's it. It's interesting, you can be sure Jews didn't give that plant that name. It's a name that just evolved because it just, that's a Jew. Right? You take the Jewish people, you cut everything away from them, you uproot them completely, put them somewhere else, boom, there they are, they're growing again. Why? How is that possible? How is that possible? You know, let me read to you some quotes, some that you're hopefully familiar with, but maybe not. Mark Twain. The Egyptians, Babylonians, Persians rose up and filled the world with extravagant glory and splendor, until the splendor was dimmed, and they sank and ultimately perished. See, it's hard for us to understand who the Egyptians were, or who the Babylonians were, or who the Persians were. Who, you know, like, they were the superpower. In those days, they were America. Like today, you know, or the Greek Empire. The Greek Empire? Wait, the Greek Empire? The only Greek I know is Zorbo. I mean, what? Who were the Greeks? But the Greeks, they were America of the time. Right? Where are they today? The Greeks and the Romans followed in their footsteps, made a loud noise, and then disappeared. Other nations appeared and held their torch high for a while, but was burned in its own fire, and now they sit in the shadow, or have altogether vanished. This is Mark Twain saying this, and he's not a Jew. He says the Jew saw them all, he beat them all, and he's today what he was then. He does not show signs of becoming submerged, nor the weariness of old age. His aptitude has not slowed down, and his awareness as keen as ever. Listen to what Mark Twain says. Everyone is mortal in this world except the Jew. All the powers of history passed away, but the Jew remains. What is the secret of his immortality? What is the secret of the immortality of the Jewish people? Let me read you Leo Tolstoy. What is this Jew? Is not as all a strange a question as it would first appear to be. Come, let us contemplate what kind of unique creature this, whom all the rulers of all the nations of the world have disgraced and crushed and expelled and destroyed, persecuted, burned, and drowned, and despite their anger and their fury, continue to live and flourish. What is this Jew, whom they have never succeeded in enticing with all the enticements in the world, whose oppressors and persecutors only suggest that he deny his religion and cast aside the faithfulness of his ancestors? The Jew is the symbol of eternity. He is the one whom they were never able to destroy, neither bloodbath nor affliction, neither the fire nor the sword of the Inquisition succeeded in annihilating him. He is the only one who for so long has guarded the prophetic message and transmitted it to all mankind. A people such as this can never disappear. The Jew is eternal. He is the embodiment of eternity. Right? This Leo Tolstoy says the Jew is the embodiment of eternity. I'm going to explain why. I don't think Leo or Mark know why, right? But they're fascinated. Why is right here in our text. Because if your identity is a function of your country, and your country's taken away from you, you're gone. Right? That was the foundation of your identity. If your identity is a function of your possessions, and they take your possessions, you're gone. If a person's identity is a function of their wealth, and they often lose their wealth, they lose themselves because themselves was their wealth. And if a person's identity is a function of their family, not that they don't love their family, but if their family becomes the mainstay of their sense of self, and they lose their family, they lose themselves. But there's something you can't lose. You can't lose. It's your relationship to God. You can't lose your relationship to God. Nobody can really take that away from you, ever. My son, who at the time was 4 years old, at night I tried to sit with the kids and I asked them to tell me stories, teach me Torah. One evening my son Nurio said, Abba, I got a great story for you. He says, once there were a whole bunch of people on a boat, and these pirates attacked the boat. And they came on the boat, and they took everything away from everybody on the boat. I was really into the story. Yeah. And he said, but there was only one person on the boat that they couldn't take away from him what he really had. I said, who was that? He said, the Jewish man on the boat. I said, why not? He said, because Abba, the Jewish man, had the Torah, and nobody can take the Torah away from you. Nobody can take the Torah away from you. Right? That my four-year-old son, I wish I could have said things like that when I was 4 years old, instead of recite Popeye and, you know, and other wonderful things. But it's amazing. It's amazing. No one can take that away from you. Right? your spiritual accomplishment, no one can take that away from me. A friend of mine was doing a book call about holy women. And she was interviewing all these holy women. She met this woman who was in Auschwitz. She and her husband were in Auschwitz. This woman, people go to blessings for. She's a very holy woman. And so this friend of mine said, "How did you survive Auschwitz?" And the woman said, "Auschwitz isn't so bad. Auschwitz wasn't so bad. The Germans could only get our bodies, but could never get our souls." Be on a level like that, right? What's the source of my identity? Is it my body? If it is, I lose my body, I'm gone. If it's my house, if it is, I lose my house, I'm gone. But Judaism says the source of one's identity is their relationship to God. And if that's the source of their identity, then they have an eternal identity. Their identity becomes the embodiment of eternity. Right? The embodiment of eternity. It's a powerful teaching. This is the teaching of the Jewish people. You know, when I was growing up, I had a very confused sense of what it meant to be Jewish. You know, I didn't like being Jewish. I was proud, but as a minority, in order to overcome some kind of inferiority complex, I was proud. But I didn't know what I was proud about. And most of my Jewish identity was based on guilt. Right? Because them, us, you know. And I remember growing up thinking that Jews are smarter than everybody else. And that's what makes us special. We're smarter than everybody else. And that was confirmed in my life because in class I was the smartest kid. And I said, of course, because I'm Jewish. Well, makes sense. And that was going very well until grade 2. Right? Because in grade 2, I was the smartest kid in class. And about 2 months into the school year, this little Japanese girl came into the class. Her name was Patty Nikanani. And I tell you, that was my first identity crisis. Because she was brilliant. She knocked me out of the ring. This little Patty Nikanani. And I kept looking at her saying, is she Jewish? Could she be Jewish with a name like Nikanani? It was a big thing for me because I grew up thinking that Jews are smarter. Right? Jews are smarter. Then as I started to get older, I thought, well, Jews are better. Jews are more ethical. But then I see Jews do some very horrifying crimes. And that also burst my bubble of Jewish identity. The essence of Jewish identity is a relationship with the divine. The essence of Jewish identity is being a child of covenant. And that's what makes the Jewish people special. When the Jewish people sever their relationship with God, then they're not so special. Because that's the only thing that's special about them. And that specialness is not reserved for them. It's not just for them. It's not God saying to the Jewish people, let's elope and turn our backs on the world. But rather the Jewish people are to be a inspiration to the world to enter into a relationship with God and to establish their identity based on a relationship with God. What is identity? Identity is a function of identification. That's what it is. What do you identify with? If you identify with money, then money becomes your source of identity. If you identify with power, then power becomes your source of identity. But Avram was being asked to disidentify with everything and identify with God and make God the source of his identity. There's an idea in Judaism called the Shekhinah, the divine presence. That one experiences God both transcendental and as immanent. One experiences the divine as beyond us and yet also within us and yet beyond us. There's a Hasidic saying that goes like this. If I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not I and you are not you. All right. Now often people think that means, you know, be yourself, do your own thing. It's much more than that. The truth is, I am I because you are you. That's a fact. And you are you because I am I. Science has proven that there is no such thing as an isolated reality. An independent reality does not exist. Science has proven this. Right? Once upon a time they thought there was an atom, they thought there was a this, they thought there was a that. Now quantum physics is realizing that these are all conceptualizations of a relationship. And what they're discovering in experiments is that the results of the experiment changes based on the relationship that the experimenter sets up with the experiment. This is a whole new thing, if you know a little bit about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that all of a sudden they realize there isn't such a hard, objective reality which is not influenced by the viewer. Right? In Newtonian physics, there's a belief that we can stand behind the microscope, the telescope, the magnifying glass, whatever it is, and look at the world and describe it. As if our description, as if our consciousness of the world does not influence what it is that we're seeing. Now quantum physics is showing more and more and more. It's not true. A scientist, John Wheeler from Princeton, he said, based on our findings, is it possible that the world is coming into existence because we're asking questions? Can you imagine, these are the kind of questions that scientists are now asking? Of the role of our subjective minds in influencing the world? And therefore they're now coming to new realizations that there's no such thing as a thing, but a relationship. And things are conceptualizations of relationships. This is what they're saying in science now. This is fascinating. Because there is no such thing as an independent reality, which is basically the scientific expression of here, O Israel, God is one. Right? Because there is no absolute plurality in the universe, because nothing's independent. There isn't absolute multiplicity of many independent things. There's only one reality with internal relationships. Okay? Internal relationships. Alright. And that's, you know, the unified field theory is a scientific expression of here, O Israel, God is one. Right? If God is one, then everything in the universe is one. Because if everything is divine being, a manifestation of one beer, then all being will be one. And therefore it makes sense that they should find all being is one. Alright. Everything is interdefined. Everything is interdefined. And you're not you, because you're you. You're you because I'm I, and I'm I because you're you. Because we define each other. I'm part of your definition, and you're part of my definition. And that's the way it goes. I'm sure there are people that you meet that when you're in their presence, you feel really good about yourself. Are there people like that? When you're around them, you just feel, you say the right things, you act the right way. I'm sure you've had experiences where you've been with people who when you're around them, you just don't understand yourself. You say the wrong things, you know. You don't like yourself when you're around these people. Why? Aren't you the same you? No, you're not the same you. You can be transformed dramatically based on your relationships. Right? You want to change yourself? Change your relationships. Right? Because that's really yourself, is a function of all those relationships. All those relationships. When people say, I want to meet somebody with the right chemistry, it is chemistry. It's chemistry. You take an atom, a carbon atom, and you relate it to monoxide. You get carbon monoxide. Right? That's what you get. You take a carbon atom and you relate it to something else. It becomes part of a diamond. You decide who you want to be related to. Right? Because your relationships transform you. This, by the way, it's very interesting. There are different philosophies in psychology, therapy. How do you help a person? And most therapists were under, I don't know, most, many, are under the understanding that a therapist has to maintain distance from their patient. Okay? And then there's a guy named Carl Rogers. And he came up with a very different way of therapy. He said, no, the reason why these people are coming to you is they're looking for a friend. Right? They're looking for a friend. And therefore, for them to be healthy, they need to be in a healthy relationship. You have to become that healthy relationship. If you remain removed from them, right, then you're going to help them. Because the reason why they're sick is because they're involved in sick relationships. And you can be the healthy relationship for them. Right? By the way, it's interesting. There's a piece from Perkei Avot, chapters before, that says, Kone Chaver, buy yourself a friend. I would say that's a therapist. Right? That's what they call it. You know, buy yourself a friend. Pay. It's worth it to have a good friend. A good friend. Just one second. So his whole concept was to enter into a healthy relationship. Enter into a healthy relationship. The chapters of the fathers, Perkei Avot, says that Aaron, and Aaron was Moses' brother, he was fantastic in helping people do tshuva, helping people return back to God, Judaism, whatever. You know how he'd do it? He had this very simple methodology. He would say hello to people. And he would befriend them. That's what he would do. He would befriend them. Right? He'd see this guy down the street. Everybody knew this guy was a thief. Doesn't matter. Aaron, Holy Cohen Aaron, would come up to him, give him a big hug. How are you, brother? How are you feeling today? Good to see you. Right? And this guy was so overwhelmed. Aaron said hello to me? I mean, he's saying hello to a thief, a good-for-nothing criminal like me? Wow. The next time that guy was about to steal, he'd say to himself, how am I going to look at Aaron in the face tomorrow? He gives me that big smile and that big hug. That's how Aaron changed people, by entering into healthy relations with them. That's how we would do it. So we transform based on our relationships. That's what we become. We become our relationships. You have a sick relationship with somebody, then you become sick. Because you are not self-defined. You are not self-sufficient. You are not an independent reality. There's no such thing. So if my definition is a function of my relationships, then if I enter into a relationship with the eternal, with the transcendental, then the eternal and transcendental becomes part of my definition. My personal definition. Right? Within you is me, and within me is you. And if I make God the you in my life, you can't say I without you. Just like you can't say black without white. Up without down. There's no such thing as black without white. If there wasn't white in the universe, there wouldn't be black in the universe. If there wasn't up in the universe, there wouldn't be down in the universe. These things come together, right? There's no such thing. They're not separate. They're not separate. So too, there's no such thing as an I without a you, and there's no such thing as you without an I. Right? And therefore, you are part of the definition of I, and I is part of the definition of you. Now, if I enter into relation with the eternal you, then the eternal you becomes part of my personal definition. And this is what's referred to as the divine presence, or the indwelling spirit, which is called the Shekhinah. The internal experience of God is a function of my relation with God. Right? If I enter into, if I seek a relation with the divine, then the divine becomes part of my personal definition. When Leo Tolstoy says the Jew is the embodiment of eternity, and that really shocked me. That's a strong thing to say. But you can become the embodiment of eternity by entering into relationship with eternity. Do you follow this? If you enter into relationship with eternity, then you embody eternity, and eternity embodies you. Right? Embodies you. That, by the way, little tangent, I believe that's how it's possible for people to make Jesus into a God. Not that it's right, it's wrong. Right? But to believe that a human being can embody divinity is not wrong. It's not wrong. What's wrong is then when you begin to think that they have now become divinity. That's wrong. Right? I mean, if I enter into a relation with you, that I embody you and you embody me, but I don't become you and you don't become me. But there is a healthy we. If I enter a relation with God, then that mutual inclusiveness, that mutual interdefinition happens. Because I enter in such a relationship. What is God asking of Avram to do? What Avram is doing is going through a total transformation. Right? This is a completely new human being. Because this is not like every other human being whose identity was a function of their country, of their possessions, of their family, of their birthplace. He had to let go of all of that. Strips himself completely. He had to be existentially naked of all those garments. The garment of nationalism, the garment of... He had to let go of that and take a walk with God. And make God his partner in life. And define himself in terms of his relationship to God. And then his relationship with God will be the source of wealth, power, fame. But they will be manifestations of that kind of relationship. They will not be the source of his identity. They will be manifestations of his new identity. And that's a big difference. Money, nothing wrong with money. Money's great. But not as the source of your identity. If it becomes a manifestation of your identity, okay, fine. But it's not the source of my identity. My clothes is not the source of my identity. Right? It's not the source of my identity, but your clothing are important. Right? Keep you warm. Functionally important. But existentially not important. Right? In terms of my very essence, my very existence, and the sense of value, my inner sense of value, it's not my clothing that'll give it to me. Right? I have to feel that my existence, my being, not my body, not my money, but first and foremost, my being is anchored in eternal being. And that is the foundation of Jewish experience. That is it. That's really, you know, in a nutshell, what Judaism is about. Every time I do a mitzvah, a commandment, what I'm essentially doing is anchoring my being within an eternal being. Every time I do a mitzvah, what I'm essentially doing is defining my identity in terms of a relationship with God. And it's important to know that when God says, I will make you a great nation, what is a great nation? So if you look in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 7, which you can look later, write it down. There's a verse that says, for what great nation is there that has God so close to them? What makes you a great nation? A nation that shows that God is close to them. Not a nation with a big army. Not a nation with a lot of land. Not a nation that has tremendous economic influence. That's not what the Jewish people are supposed to represent in the universe. The Jewish people are to represent that a great nation is a nation who is close to God. A nation who defines their behavior in terms of its relationship to God. And when a person does that, demonstrates that, right, they become a great nation. And they inspire other nations to be great. Other nations to be great. So what did we just learn? Let me summarize it. Alright? Abraham is told, go to yourself. We see that simultaneously he's told to go to himself, and yet he's being told to leave himself. The truth is he's being told to leave what others call self, to accept a new kind of self. A self which is not defined by anything of this world, but rather defined by a relationship with the divine. And when a person defines themselves in terms of their relationship to the divine, then the divine, the eternal, the transcendental, becomes part of their personal definition. And they will experience immortality. They will experience eternity. And that is what Jewish identity is. Does that mean every Jew has it? Every Jew has the possibility for it. Every Jew has the potential for it. And ultimately every human being has the potential for it. Right? The question is, do I do something about it? And so, this is again, we're looking at Avraham not only as an individual in history. We're looking at Avraham as a spiritual archetype for our lives. Right? What do I learn from Avraham? What was his journey that he was being told to take? It's the journey that we all are going to take, whether we want to or not. Because life will challenge us and say, who are you? Life will say that over and over again. Maybe we won't be open to hear it. Maybe we're going to succeed in some way, filtering out that gnawing inner voice that keeps saying, who are you? Are you your money? Are you your power? Who are you? And unless a person answers that question, or at least addresses that question, they have not yet begun to live. It's what I believe anyways. We have not yet begun to live until we're ready to ask that question. Who am I? That is the question that God asked the first man. After the sin of the first man, God said, where are you? And certainly God knew where he was physically. But the question is, where are you spiritually? Right? Where have you placed yourself? Where have you invested yourself? Where do you see yourself? And Avram is the answer to that question. Because the first man didn't answer. He said, I'm hiding. Right? I'm hiding from you. He thought God was asking him some geographical question. God was asking the existential question. The question. Who are you? And when God says, seek yourself, go for yourself, let go of yourself, Avram, through his activity, answers the question that the first man couldn't answer. Because the answer of Judaism is, my I is defined by a relationship with an eternal, transcendental, ultimate reality, which we call, some people call God, but I prefer to call Hashem.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.